My Govana and my Inklings, and welcome back to Catamompus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are delicately sliced into tiny pieces and examined closely for literary lessons. Today we're starting our series on The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien, which you may know better as the first part of The Lord of the Rings. If you're unfamiliar with the story of The Fellowship of the Ring, or if you know the story well enough but don't remember where it begins and ends because the story is so long, allow me to illuminate. The book opens in Hobbiton in the Shire before Frodo receives the ring, and then follows him through receiving it, discovering its true nature, carrying it through various shenanigans to Rivendell, volunteering to take it to Mordor, through Moria and Lothlorien, to the banks of the River Anduin above Rauras Falls. The book ends with a chapter titled The Breaking of the Fellowship, where Frodo and Sam depart on their own, leaving Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, and Boromir on the northern bank with their kinsmen, Merry and Pippin. That summary really doesn't do it justice, but then neither does the synopsis from the back cover, which describes the story of the entire trilogy in even broader strokes than what I've done here. Before we start our reading, let's rewind a bit and look at some of the literary context for this book. As most of you already know, Fellowship is the first book in a trilogy, or more accurately, the first part in a three-part novel. It is not, however, the beginning of the story. The predecessor to this book is The Hobbit, a much shorter work which Tolkien wrote during a time when he was engaged in the practice of writing things for the young children in his family. Many of the things mentioned or explained in The Hobbit carry over to the world of Middle-earth, including the character named in the first sentence of the first chapter of The Fellowship of the Ring. Which brings me to the point where I ask, what kind of book is this? Is this a sequel, some of which we won't understand if we haven't read the book before it? Or is this a book that can tell its own story without help from other texts? In a way, I think that's a trick question, because The Lord of the Rings isn't a self-contained story. There are references to and songs about tales that take place in the distant past, and it's clear, even to the casual reader, that when Tolkien wrote this story, he wasn't actually engaged in writing a story. He was engaged in exploring a world. So, to look again at the question, is this book a sequel or the first book in its own series? I think we have to conclude that it is a sequel for at least one big reason. The author thought it was necessary to include a prologue titled Concerning Hobbits. If I could, I would play the song by the same title as I read, but unfortunately there are a number of legal reasons why I can't do that. So, here we go. The Fellowship of the Ring by J.R.R. Tolkien. Prologue. Concerning Hobbits. This book is largely concerned with hobbits, and from its pages a reader may discover much of their character and a little of their history. Further information will also be found in the selection from the Red Book of Westmarch that has already been published under the title of The Hobbit. That story was derived from the earlier chapters of the Red Book, composed by Bilbo himself, the first hobbit to become famous in the world at large, and called by him There and Back Again, since they told of his journey to the east and his return, an adventure which later involved all the hobbits in the great events of that age that are here related. Many, however, may wish to know more about this remarkable people from the outset, while some may not possess the earlier book. For such readers, a few notes on the more important points are here collected from hobbit lore, and the first adventure is briefly recalled. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today, for they love peace and quiet and good tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside is their favorite haunt. They do not, and did not, understand or like machines more complicated than a forge bellows, a watermill, or a handloom, though they were skillful with tools. Even in ancient days they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk, as they call us, and now they avoid us with dismay, and are becoming hard to find. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft in their movements. They possessed from the first the art of disappearing swiftly and silently when large folk whom they did not wish to meet come blundering by, and this art they have developed until, to men, it may seem magical. But hobbits have never, in fact, studied magic of any kind, and their elusiveness is due solely to a professional skill that heredity and practice, and a close friendship with the earth, have rendered inimitable by bigger and clumsier races. For they are a little people, smaller than dwarves, less stout and stocky, that is, even when they are not actually much shorter. Their height is variable, ranging from 2 to 4 feet of our measure. They seldom now reach 3 feet, but they have dwindled, they say, and in ancient days they were taller. According to the Red Book, Bandabris Took, Bull Roarer, son of Insegrim II, was 4'5" and able to ride a horse. He was surpassed in all Hobbit records by only 2 famous characters of old, but that curious matter is dealt with in this book. As for the Hobbits of the Shire, with whom these tales are concerned, in the days of their peace and prosperity they were a merry folk. They dressed in bright colors, being notably fond of yellow and green, but they seldom wore shoes, since their feet had tough, leathery soles and were clad in thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which was commonly brown. Thus, the only craft little practiced among them was shoemaking. But they had long and skillful fingers and could make many other useful and comely things. Their faces were, as a rule, good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat, and drink, often and heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times, and of 6 meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties, and in presents, which they gave away freely and eagerly accepted. It is plain indeed that in spite of later estrangement, hobbits are relatives of ours, far nearer to us than elves or even than dwarves. Of old they spoke the languages of men after their own fashion and liked and disliked much the same things as men did. But what exactly our relationship is can no longer be discovered. The beginning of hobbits lies far back in the elder days that are now lost and forgotten. Only the elves still preserve any records of that vanished time, and their traditions are concerned almost entirely with their own history, in which men appear seldom, and hobbits are not mentioned at all. Yet it is clear that the hobbits had, in fact, lived quietly in Middle-earth for many long years before other folk became even aware of them. And the world being, after all, full of strange creatures beyond count, these little people seemed of very little importance. But in the days of Bilbo and of Frodo, his heir, they suddenly became, by no wish of their own, both important and renowned, and troubled the councils of the wise and the great. Of course, it couldn't be so simple as all that, and this prologue goes on for another 12 pages, including sections on the smoking of pipeweed, the geography of the Shire, the finding of the ring, and the keeping of records in the Shire. Tolkien was, if nothing else, very thorough, and he wanted all the information to be available, whether it was desired or not. In a way, this is like a tutorial for the book. Since the first several chapters are concerned exclusively with Hobbits of the Shire, the author chose to preface his book with a section he might as well have titled, "Everything You Need to Know About Hobbits Before We Get Started." I will not say that this method is better or worse than integrating one's world building into the story itself, because what is better or worse depends entirely on the purpose of the text, or what the author needs in order to convey his message. We can tell from the first words that the author is sharing a world with us. He's saying, "Look at this world, isn't it amazing? Don't you want to know more about it?" He then proceeds to offer us as much information as he thought anyone might be interested in, and a little more. So, can this book stand on its own? Well, yes and no. It can, But then that may be because it has a bunch of information attached to the beginning and the end for exploring more of the world. One last thing I'd like to add as we wrap up for this week is that Fellowship is much less a gateway to a series than some other books are. When you read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or Warriors Into the Wild, you're setting up with the basics of the world as the characters learn about them, and it draws you deeper into the setting as you go. In contrast, Fellowship tosses you into the deep end of a world that has literally thousands of years of history, some of which is known and relayed to the reader, while the rest is left unsaid or even forgotten. This might be because of Tolkien's academic style, but I think it's more likely because we think of Lord of the Rings as a series, but it's really just one book. Think on that for a while. That's all I have for you this week. The random question of the day is, if you could visit only one location in Middle-earth for a single day, which location would you choose? Until next time, stay warm and dry, my Inklings. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a fantastic audience. I'll see you on the other side.